Where are we in prophecy today? Many of us who have studied God's Word for a long time realize that there are many events just crashing down on us on almost a daily basis. Just this past week, we were inundated with a Gorbachev visit to the United Nations, the declaration of peace that he gave, the reduction of arms that he promised. And then we have Yasser Arafat saying, well, he's willing to recognize Israel as a state, and he's willing to negotiate with them directly. Troops are coming out of Afghanistan, they're coming out of Angola, and it seems as though that many, many things are happening which look like that maybe man is going to solve his problems. And somehow some of these things just don't seem to all mesh with all the things that are talked about in the Bible, because we've been looking for so many different events to happen, and yet at the same time we need to realize that many events can be taking place all simultaneously. For example, we still have famine in the Sudan and Ethiopia and Eritrea. We have terrible floods and disaster in Bangladesh and China, and now with the tremendous earthquake that just happened 2 days ago in Armenia and southern Russia. And all of these events, what is happening? What is going on? Is Christ ready to return now? Is he ready to sound the trumpet and come back to this earth and rescue mankind from all of his troubles and difficulties? Well, we're going to answer some of those questions, and we're going to look at a little bit different perspective, and we will ask the question along with this: how far has God determined that man is going to go before he intervenes in world affairs and sends Jesus Christ to return to this earth? Now, there are many people saying we need to look to Europe, because in 1992, Europe and the European Economic Community is going to come together as one single economic unity. And that's something to really watch, because it is known that before political events happen, economics leads the way many, many decades, and sometimes as much as 50, 60, 70, 80, and in some cases in history, 100 years before the political realities come. And I think one of the biggest political realities that we are going to see that is contained in the scriptures and the prophecies of the end time is the political reality that there is going to be a tremendous and unbelievable world structure. And I think we are beginning to see this come together. And if you will notice that at Gorbachev's speech at the United Nations, he has finally said, well, let us all come together as nations, and to bring peace and to bring freedom and to have choice and all of these things, so that mankind will at last have peace. How close are we to that time and to that event? We know that the Bible tells us when they say peace, peace, we know that we are getting close. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians, the 5th chapter, because this tells us a little bit about the peace overture that is happening right now. So let's keep that in mind. They're saying there is peace. And while the prophecy that backs this New Testament prophecy up, the one in the Old Testament, says, when they say peace, peace, and there is no peace. Here, 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul writes the brethren in the church in Thessalonica and says, but of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. See, as Christians, we are to understand the times. We are to understand the seasons. We are to understand when these events generally are going to occur. However, we will see that Jesus gave us some guidelines on how to handle it and what to look for. But even during the days of the Apostle Paul, many of them thought that Jesus was going to return. Many of them thought that he was coming soon. Many of them thought that in his lifetime, in their lifetimes rather, that Jesus was going to return. When are these things going to take place? And after all, this is one of the most important questions, and actually one of the last questions that the disciples asked Jesus before he ascended into heaven. When is it going to happen? So here's a clue right here. Verse 2. chapter 5, 1 Thessalonians, "For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord comes as a thief in the night." Now, let's understand something about human behavior so we can understand this verse. This doesn't mean necessarily just in the analogy that we think of as a thief breaking into a house in the night. In that particular sense, it has a greater and an overall more fundamental spiritual meaning to this than what we've understood. First of all, who is the thief? The thief is Satan the devil, because he wanted to steal the kingdom, correct? What is it that men like? Men love darkness, for their deeds are evil. So we're talking about at a time which, to mankind's point of view, is going to look like enlightenment, is going to look like progress, is going to look like wonderful spiritual enlightenment to us as human beings. However, it is going to be the darkest. It is going to be the gloomiest. It is going to be the undoing of all humankind. Verse 3, "For when they shall say peace and safety," very interesting statement, peace and safety. That is secure from war. We have peace. Isn't that what we're hearing now? More peace than ever before. But it's an interesting translation, safety. In the original Greek, it means prosperity. Peace and prosperity. And I want to ask you, what is on everyone's mind today? Are we going to have enough money to succeed till tomorrow? Is the economy going to stay up? Are we going to have peace? Are we going to have war? Just exactly what is happening. But Jesus said, "When they shall say peace and safety," or peace and prosperity, "then sudden destruction comes upon them." Now notice this other analogy. "As travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." Now let's think about this analogy a little bit. Does a woman who is pregnant, when she gets down to the last part of the pregnancy, know exactly when the baby is going to be born? No, she does not know. All the symptoms are there. Everything is ready, but she doesn't know. And all of a sudden, then the pain starts. And then the baby is born. So it's the same way with what's going to happen in this last generation, the end time of human existence, under human rule, with Satan the devil as the overall ruler, giving sway over all governments. Things are going to go along. We're going to recognize that we have problems. We are going to recognize that there is something constantly growing and growing and growing. And yet, at the same time, we will hear them say, which we do today, that if we keep things moving along the way that they are, well, everything's going to work out. Now, how long will this continue? The Bible doesn't tell us. So that's why we'll see a little later that Jesus told us to watch, because that's the only way we are going to know. And I've seen so many people try and say, well, this is going to happen, then that's going to happen, Christ is coming. You know, they started way back during the days of the apostles. Well, Christ is going to come just before or just after John the apostle dies. Well, he didn't. It was been many, many centuries since then. Then about 1000 AD, they said Christ has got to return now, because we have wars, we have famines, we have drought, we have all of these disasters happening. Then when the Black Plague came, the bubonic plague in the 1300s, they thought, boy, Christ has got to return now, but he didn't. And then the Seventh-day Adventists said, well, Christ is going to return in 1844. It never happened. Jehovah's Witnesses said he's coming in 1918. It didn't happen. Other ones said he's going to come right at the end of Second World War or in the midst of it. It didn't happen. Others said, well, now we have the atomic bomb and Jesus has got to return. Didn't happen. So then we have the hydrogen bomb. Jesus has got to return. It didn't happen. Now we have missiles and planes and all sorts of ways of destruction of all living things on the planet. And yet Christ hasn't returned yet. So where are we in prophecy? Well, let's go back to Matthew, the 24th chapter, and let's review a very basic set of scriptures as to the whole fundamental fulcrum of where we are in prophecy. And we are going to see that the things that are taking place here are exactly as Jesus said they would be, and we have to intersperse it with the other scriptures, which tell us about peace and prosperity, which tell us about peace and safety. And we also have to take a look at another very important statement that Jesus gave us concerning how these events would be. Matthew 24, and let's pick it up in verse 3. Now, for those of you who have studied your Bibles for a long time, and you've been a student of prophecy for a long time, these are going to be very basic scriptures. But let's understand something, that the scriptures are living, they are moving, they describe events, and we're going to see as we read this that all of these things have been magnified and intensified, even from the time of Jesus Christ down until the present day. But there is another clue that we need to look into, and there are other events that we need to examine to just ask the question, how do we stand in relationship to the events being fulfilled in prophecy? Here in verse 3 of Matthew 24, and as he, Jesus, sat on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world? Now in the King James it says world, but it doesn't mean the destruction, physical destruction of the orb of the earth. This is talking about the end of the age of man's rule under the sway of Satan the devil. So Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceive you. And I submit to you that there are more deceivers, there are more people masquerading out there as ministers, as spiritualists, and it's also bringing in all of the pagan religions. Why, just today, up in San Francisco, a man came and to a Buddhist priest and said, look, I have this business down here, and I've been reading about Buddhism, and it says that the 42nd year is the hardest year in your life, and now I want you to come down here because they're putting graffiti on the store, they're stealing out of the store. I want you to come down and chase away all the evil spirits. So sure enough, the monk came down in his orange robe and rattled and banged and spread incense around. And we have all kinds of religions. We have almost every so-called Christian televangelist finding themselves in court over adultery and homosexuality or stealing or lying or taking money under false pretenses. We have every politician of every ilk saying that they're born-again Christians. And the Bible says, you need to take heed that no one deceives you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall deceive many. And of course, even here, we could go into three or four sermons on the problems and difficulties with that. Well, we just have to conclude, yes, that is happening now, today, at this time, right this minute. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now intersperse that with the other scripture which says, peace and safety. Do we hear of both? Yes, we do. Are they both happening? Yes, they are. Are we living in a land of plenty today? Yes, we are. Are there famines and starvations in other places? Yes, there are. They are happening at the same time. So these events all compound and interweave and come together in one great, huge picture. He says, see that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. And nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in different places. And I would have to say in this year, 1988, every one of these things have intensified. We're having more pestilence right now. We sit on the verge right here in the United States of a combination of drought, tremendous infestation of locusts on the soft underbelly of the United States and the Caribbean, because the locust plague from Africa were blown over here by one of the hurricanes, Hurricane Gilbert, the most tremendous and powerful hurricane that has been in over 200 years, and neatly deposited on all the green islands of the Caribbean's tremendous locusts. What a feeding and breeding ground. So we have that there. We have the killer bee. We have the drought. We have all of our industrial toxification of the air and the water and the land and our bodies and our minds. All of those things are taking place. So we know somewhere the end has got to be. But when? Let's see. Maybe there's some more things we can look at to see when the end will be. Now notice verse 8. Jesus said, "These are the beginning of sorrows." Now, if these are the beginning of sorrows, we're stuck with another problem that we cannot answer, and that is, how long are the sorrows? How intense do they become? How much are they going to be multiplied? Are we going to see the United States become like Lebanon and Beirut? Are we going to see, and you know, in Lebanon and Beirut, where they're having all the wars and the factions and the shooting and living in destruction and wretchedness, children are born, people eat, people conduct business, people sleep. It's a miserable way to live, but they're living. They're still there, full of sorrow, full of wretchedness, full of horrible things that are happening, but it's still existing, what? Side by side with the prosperity of the rest of the world. Look at all of Africa. Africa is in a terrible mess of plagues and diseases and famine, starvation, killing, bludgeoning. And what do we have? This world is really in the throes of sorrow. But how long are these sorrows going to be? We're not told. And then it says in verse 9, "And they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake." No, I haven't been delivered up. I haven't been arrested for keeping the Sabbath or the holy days or obeying God or refusing to eat unclean meats. I haven't been chased out of, well, in some senses I have, from internal strife within a church organization because people wanted to follow their own way in philosophy instead of following God's way. You know, the Bible tells us to separate ourselves from those who do that. But I have been hauled up before government people to explain why I believe what I believe. So that hasn't happened yet. When will it happen? How's it going to happen? How's it going to take place? We don't know. That's why Jesus said to watch. Because you know, sooner or later, the day is going to come. Verse 10. "Then shall many be offended and shall betray one another, shall hate one another." Now we can see this building up more and more and more. This is true. Why, down here in L.A., they had a rash of just shooting people on the freeway. So up in our area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, I live about 100 miles south of there, the other night a man was coming home, minding his own business, and someone came along and shot him right in the back of the head. Luckily, his wife was able to steer the car and pull it over to the side of the freeway, but he was dead right when they pulled over to the side of the freeway. So these things are happening, hating one another. "And many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall grow cold." No love, no human kindness, no nothing, just icy, just cold, just miserable. And that's the way this society is becoming. "But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved." Now, I'm sure that you've read that or heard that many times yourself, but it says there has to be endurance. So it shows we're going to have to go through a lot of things. And it shows that many events are going to transpire. "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end shall come." How long is that going to be? How powerful is that going to be? Of what magnitude will this assume? Will it just be the two witnesses? Will it be one church? Will it be one evangelist? Will it be many? Will it be many small groups? Will it be all of us together? Will it be different individuals here and there? The Bible doesn't really make it absolutely clear. But you can be guaranteed that God is going to have to determine when it has been preached and when enough is enough. So again, there is a flexibility factor in there that God has. Then it goes on saying, "And you, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand." And I imagine when they were compiling the New Testament together, they were reading that, and God inspired them to put this statement right there, "Whoso reads, let him understand." Now, we have to have a temple built. We have to have sacrifices begin. We have to have a holy place. All of that has to take place before the end begins. And the beginning of the end is the tribulation. All of these other events lead up to it. Many other factors have to fit into it. We know from the book of Daniel that there has to be the king of the north, the king of the south. We know from the book of Revelation chapter 13, there's got to be the beast power. We also know that there has to be a great religious power that is going to reinforce the authority of the beast. I've heard people say Reagan's the beast. I doubt it. I've heard people say Gorbachev is the beast. And furthermore, a lot of the religious Russians who still practice their religion say that that birthmark on his forehead is the mark of Cain. I doubt it. I don't think Gorbachev is the man. But who is the man? Doesn't tell us. We're to watch. So we need to watch every one of these events. But I think that rather than these things suddenly taking place, I think we're going to see that the momentum builds. One event builds upon another, which leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. And I think that economically speaking, in Revelation 13, when it comes to the mark of the beast and the enforcement of that, first there's got to be an acceptable amalgamated world government. There has to be an acceptable world economy. So keep your eyes on that. Because those are events that have to take place. And I think we're inching closer and closer and closer to the effectiveness of the mark of the beast. We're inching closer and closer and closer to a one-world government. We're inching closer and closer and closer to a uniform economic standard. So all of those things are important. And when those take place and the temple is built and the sacrifices begin, you better pay attention. You better make sure that you're doing what you ought to be doing, because events are going to come upon you. But are those the only things we need to look to understand where we are in prophecy today? Let's come over here to verse 36. And let's understand what Jesus said, and let's look at it from another perspective, because there is another event that is happening today that we need to be aware of. And maybe this will help us understand some of the prophecies in the Old Testament as to why certain things are given in the way that they have been portrayed. Where we have read it in the past, maybe we haven't understood it in the way that we need to. But here we find in verse 36 the very words of Jesus, "But of that day and hour knows no man, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only." And so we know it's in the hands of God the Father when that day is going to take place. And we know that only Jesus knew when he gave that event, beginning with the book of Revelation, when he gave all of those events in sequence to the Apostle John. Now let's read the next verse. "But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." How were the days of Noah? Do we know how the days of Noah were? Do we understand what took place? Why was it that God only saved 8 people? What was it that they were doing? Now it says here, "For in the days of Noah that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage." We're doing that today. But is that the only thing we are doing? Is that the only thing that human beings were accomplishing then? Is that all that was being done? What was being done that was so absolutely, incredibly wicked that God had to destroy all human life and all animal life except those that were taken into the ark? What happened? What transpired? Do you suppose that we may have a clue as to what was going on then by what is going on now? I want to look at another aspect of things that we haven't touched on in quite exactly the same way, and that is the aspect of technology. The aspect of just a couple of very important and profound verses in the account concerning Noah that we need to understand. Now, I want to read to you a couple of articles and show you some things as to some of the scientific and technological advances that are going on right this minute. They're going to have an absolute profound bearing upon our lives, a profound bearing on when God is going to intervene and send Jesus Christ back to this earth. So let me get those articles and I'll read them to you, and I think you're going to find them completely astounding. The first article, and I think it's very interesting that both of these articles were in the same paper on the same day. And as you know, that we're having a tremendous increase in the amount of space technology and progress, and they're talking about putting up a space station with all nations being able to participate, and this would be the first launch off into the universe. Well, in order to accomplish that, they need to know where they are going. And what you are seeing here is a radio telescopic view of a proposed map of our galaxy. And as you can see, it looks very much like what we would call a flying saucer. Now, let me read some of the things in the article so you can understand what this is talking about. You saw by the headline, A Galactic Vision. Rex Rivolo, a map maker. But instead of sketching the boundaries of the Earth's continents and oceans, he's planning to map the entire Milky Way galaxy, the star system in which we live. And apparently our solar system in that galaxy is out of one little spiral about two-thirds over on what you saw on the picture of this on the right-hand side. So our solar system is just a teeny-weeny little speck. Within the next 6 years, Rivolo hopes to create the first detailed map ever of the galaxy. The multi-million dollar project will show the nurseries where stars are born, because God is still creating stars. God is creating always. Reveal the galaxy's internal structure and serve as a valuable navigational tool for the astronauts who someday will venture into the dark voids of space. Quite an interesting statement, isn't it? And then he drew the analogy saying, well, in the 1500s, they were drawing maps of the world, and this led to exploration of the world. Now look what we've done with the world. Rivolo hopes his proposal will become the standard reference map for astronauts and astronomers during the next 30 years. As much as maps have done in the past, his project will lead to discoveries about the universe the scientists can't imagine now, he believes. Now let me read just another section in this, because we have quite a bit to understand in what is happening. On a television screen in his laboratory, he examines what may be the largest object in the Milky Way, a gigantic molecular cloud known simply as number 97. It appears as a tiny greenish dot, but computer analysis tells him it's about 6 million times more massive than our sun, and about 250 million billion miles away. Now that makes my brain go boing, because I can't think in terminology of these things. You know what God gives the challenge to man, and we'll see in just a minute back here in the book of Isaiah. God tells man to stand forth and bring forth his cause. Now, why would he challenge man that way unless God knew that man would be doing things like this? Let's read on here just a little bit. Scientists now know that the Milky Way looks something like a warped phonograph record with a large bulge at the center. Surrounding this disk is a halo of older stars, and spread out further from the halo are large amounts of dim materials known as galactic cornea. The sun is located along a spiral arm of stars a bit more than halfway from the disk's center. The disk is about 100,000 light years in diameter. Now, a light year is a speed of light is how long it takes light to travel, and that is 186,000 miles per second. Let me read this here. Yes, 186,000 miles per second. So that means that this one galaxy that he is studying is 6 trillion miles across. 6 trillion miles across. Now let's go to the book of Isaiah, because God has something to say about man's inquiry. Let's go to Isaiah, the 40th chapter. And this is just as much as a sign in prophecy, where we are in prophecy today, as anything else, and especially when I couple it together with two other things that I want to draw your attention to. Isaiah, the 40th chapter. Let's pick it up here in verse 12. Why would man be told this from God? Why would God give this challenge to him unless mankind was coming to the point that he had such technology that he could almost challenge the very powers of God? At least he could think he is. You see, and we're told in this world that science and technology is going to save us, that we can solve all of our problems with science and technology. Listen, science and technology cannot save us, because that's not our problem. The human problem is sin. And any science and technology that we have is only going to reflect our sin. So God gives his challenge. He says, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hands? And who has meted out heaven with a span, and comprehends the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighs the mountains in scales and the hills in balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, who's taught him? And with whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him in the path of knowledge and judgment? Who taught him knowledge? Who showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are all as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust in a balance. And behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing. Now, verse 17, all nations before him are as nothing and are counted less than nothing and vanity. Well, human beings don't think so. They think this is great. They think this information is knowledge and is wonderful and great and marvelous, and we're going to do such great and spectacular things. And God, we don't need you. No, we idolize our technology. We idolize our minds. We idolize what we can do. So God throws out the challenge. He says, verse 21, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you? Have you not understood from the beginning, from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. And that it is God that stretches out the heavens as a curtain. So man now is going to make maps of it and travel out in space. I don't think it's going to be the way that man has planned it out to be. Because, you see, God has one thing that is sure and important and true. God controls everything. God is God. And you can be also sure of another thing. Whatever man does, it's going to fail. Even the good that people do is going to fail. All you have to do is just look at whatever city, whatever town has feeding the homeless, taking care of the problem of the homeless. No, the more that they're fed, the more that they have an increased number of homeless. Has all of our research into science saved us from sickness and disease? No, it hasn't saved us from sickness and disease. Have we been able to save ourselves? No, we haven't been able to save ourselves. So when God throws his challenge out to mankind, he says, you need to understand that I am God. That's what he's saying here. Do you understand that God is God? Do you worship God for what he is? Is your Father in heaven above and holding up the universe with Jesus Christ is at his right hand? Is that how you view God? Because God is almighty and the great and fantastic and marvelous God who's created everything that there is. And we're going to see some more fantastic things that God has created. Let's go on. He says, to whom then, verse 25, will you liken me? Or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes up on high, and behold who has created these things. That's what God is challenging the scientists to do. But he hasn't given God any credit for anything. God is the one who has made it. He says, who has created these things, that brings out their host by number. So he's going to count all the stars? Didn't God challenge Abraham to say, now if you can tell all the stars, then I can tell you that your seed is going to be like the stars of heaven. Can you number them, Abraham? And Abraham couldn't, so now we have all of these fantastic telescopes. Can we number the stars? Or we can start counting, but where are you going to end? Because it's infinite. It goes on and on. God says there's no beginning, there's no ending with him. And he made the beginning and ending as far as mankind is concerned. So he says, lift up. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power and not one fails. So that's quite a challenge. That's quite a challenge to the scientists who look out into the universe. Now that's what you would call, using a Greek terminology, macro. Macro is big, large, gigantic, huge. So that's what they're doing in studying the universe. Now let me read you part of another article that was on the same page, the same day, in the same newspaper, which talks about the micro then, the small, the infinitesimal, the unseen. Here in the same article, Myscopracy in Action, or in Motion. What are the scientists doing at the other end of the spectrum? We saw what they're trying to do in the universe. Now let's see what they're trying to do in the cells of life. Read from this article, showing the ability of mankind, showing what they are doing at the other end. It says, by marrying the venerable light microscope with advanced video technology, scientists have opened a dramatic new window on the life of the cell. The result has been nothing less than a revolution in myscopracy, enabling researchers to observe as never before the bustling activity within living cells and to inspect the important structure previously invisible. It goes on saying, the video has made it possible to manipulate images so that the system is like a photographer's dream. You can bring out the kind of detail you want to bring out. The scientist equipped with the state-of-the-art instruments today can see living cellular structure in far greater detail than ever before. And they can see features as small as 1/4,000ths. So this is 14 thousandths the width of a human hair. Now that is incredible. We're going to see a picture in just a minute of what that is. Ultimately, one expert says, scientists have at their fingertips real time, three-dimensional displays so that you can virtually walk through the cell and look at the chemical and molecular constituents in action. Instead of looking through an eyepiece, the scientist uses the advanced microscopes by sitting before a video monitor. Now let me turn the page and continue the article. In the 1930s, scientists devised instruments that use beams of electrons which have a far shorter wavelength instead of light. And the revolving power of the electronic or electron microscopes, their ability to discriminate between two points extremely close together, is 10,000 times greater than that of just the optical microscope, which was originally invented in England in the latter part of the 19th century. So they're able to make this so much greater. The resolution on it is absolutely incredible, and they can actually view living cells functioning, expanding, dividing, growing, dying. What is this going to lead to? Well, we'll see in just a minute. The newest developments that have come along in taking TV pictures or video pictures from slightly different angles, combining them to create three-dimensional views. It takes a pair of 3D glasses to appreciate the dramatic depth of this method that it gives to cellular structures. When the pictures are projected on a screen at one of the symposium's display of this, the images seem to leap halfway out into the room, one scientist said. This is not merely entertainment, however. With the help of such images, scientists are coming to appreciate how much the cell's behavior is controlled by the spatial orientation of the features within it. Some of them equate the potential importance of 3D studies of cells to new computerized magnetic resolution imaging machines that give doctors 3D images of the inside of the body. Now, pray tell, what other creation of God is able to examine himself or the creation any greater than human beings? Now, I want to show you a picture of a cell, which then is a montage of the video microscopic image magnified 2,000 times, which shows the microtubules and the hollow fibers that make up the skeleton of cells, and it shows the pulling apart of chromosomes, which are the thick white segments of the picture, which you'll see. This is the view of the dividing of a cell. Those large white rope-type things are the chromosomes. Those fine tubular things, they don't know exactly what they are, but it has to do with the working of the cells. They can actually go into these chromosomes now and do things with the genes, because on each chromosome there are literally innumerable billions of combinations of genetic coming together or creation that can be done with these cells. Now, the next article that I'm going to read is going to almost literally make your hair stand on end. But first, let's go to the scriptures, to Genesis, the 11th chapter. Genesis, the 11th chapter, I want to cover just one verse at this time. We will come back to it in just a minute, in a short time later, not just a minute. And I want to cover the last part of verse 6. One of the reasons why God had to confound the languages, and we need to ask the question, what was the state of their technology that God had to confound their languages? We've never really thought about that, have we? Because we haven't understood what man is capable of doing. Because we have not understood how now man, as I'll show you in just the next article here, is ready to create his own technological human race that will be alive and living and active and moving and powerful. It says here, the last part of verse 6, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Now, in addition to watching the prophecies that are taking place, we need to be watching the technologies that are taking place, because that has an absolutely far more profound effect on what God is going to do. Now, I'm going to startle you with some of the next things that I'm going to tell you, so don't be upset. If you have watched some of the medical reports on television, which I watched the other night on news, and it showed this macabre picture of a human head in a pan talking with someone. And it was taken from a science fiction movie where it was designed to keep the human head alive and find a new body for this guy. Now we know that regularly they transplant organs, the heart, the liver, the lungs, they can even sew on cut off hands or severed legs. There's one man who just recently in San Francisco, he was working along and had his left hand cut off. He just calmly reached down, picked it up, had someone put it in ice, put a tourniquet around him, went off to the hospital. They sewed it back on. He's going to have the use of his left hand. Fantastic things. But what else is man doing? What else is he doing? What else is he capable of accomplishing? I want to read this article, and I want you to keep in mind what Jesus said. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Just to finish this with the head, and the doctor who reported it, Dr. Dean Edel, said that it's much simpler to keep a head alive than we've ever imagined, and that 10 years ago they were running experiments with monkeys, and they were able to keep heads alive with them talking, with them viewing, with them seeing, with them responding for 36 hours. And really, they have technology at such an advanced state right now that the only thing keeping head transplants from taking place is that they are not able to figure out how to get the spinal cord to heal itself and function again. And you can be assured, just as soon as they find that out, there are going to be head transplants. Now, I want to read this because this is just as ominous, maybe even more. Scientists learn to replace genes precisely. Now, remember what we just covered here on them being able to view the human cell in action. And this is Dateline from University of Utah. University of Utah researchers have developed a new genetic engineering technique that will allow scientists to selectively modify or replace defective genes. And of course, every evil comes out as a great advancement for humankind, right? Right. The laboratory advance reported in today's issue of Nature Journal may enhance efforts to treat human diseases by replacing abnormal genes. Such effects are expected to be tested in patients within several years. It will also contribute to the study of genetic diseases and mammalian development. The technique allows a new gene to be targeted so that it will search out and replace another gene exactly. No hit and miss. This is exact genetic replacement. That means that it will insert itself into the same location on the same chromosome as the original gene. Previously, scientists have only been able to insert most new genes at random. Such randomly inserted genes may not function properly or may interfere with the functioning of other genes. So, says Mario H. Capici, who's the research biologist scientist on this, he says, I think this is a huge step. And Capici said, the promise of research is that We can, in essence, do anything we want to do in any gene in the cell. I want to read that again, and I want you to think upon this. He said, this procedure means that in essence, we can do anything we want to do in any cell. I want to read this statement out of Genesis 11 again. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. What are human beings capable of imagining? What could they do with this technology? You know, I'm very glad that Hitler didn't have this during Second World War, aren't you? Can you imagine what would have happened? Can you imagine what would have been produced? Let's continue and finish this article. The procedure requires little knowledge of the gene being targeted. Previous techniques have usually only been applicable to a small number of extensively studied genes. This technique could be used not only to modify or replace genes, but also to boost the concentration of an insufficient gene or the elimination of an extra gene entirely. Now, I want you to expand your thinking, please, into what they are doing with in vitro fertilization, with the experiments that they are doing on animals. I want you to think that there is nothing that is restrained that man can do. Let me finish the article. The University of Utah researchers conducted their experiments on mice embryo cells. Conducting similar experiments with two different genes made the researchers more confident that the results were accurate. What did they do? They didn't tell us exactly what they did. The genetically engineered genes were introduced into the embryo cells along with additional cells capable of preventing the cells from being killed by antibiotics that were later added. Now, I said some time ago, I didn't think they would ever come up with a cure for AIDS. I will have to say, at this point, it is very possible, yea, probable, that they will come up with a cure for AIDS. But that doesn't mean the salvation of mankind. That just means he's going to live longer to create and do more evil. Because, as I said before, the problem with mankind is not technology. The problem with mankind is sin. And we have to ask the question, is not what I'm reading here, is this not sin? Is this not sinful for what they are doing? It's got to be. Because let's think about what perhaps could have been done in the past in the days of Noah. There's one more paragraph here. The technique was designed so that only embryo cells protected against the antibodies were the ones in which the new genes replaced the original genes, according to the report. Most of the embryo cells that received no new genes were killed, as were those in which the new genes were inserted in the wrong place. Therefore, the scientists could isolate the cells with properly inserted new genes. Now, I want to read this again. We can do, in essence, anything we want to do to any gene in the cell. Now, they will start out and say, oh, we're going to cure cancer. Everyone's going to say that's good. Hasn't every program introduced by Satan the devil been for good? Hasn't it always been for benefit? What did Satan tell Adam and Eve? Oh, well, if you eat this fruit, you're going to have the knowledge of good and evil. You're going to be just like God. You can decide for yourself. You don't have to rely on God. And it went to the civilization developed where that by the time of Noah, God had to destroy all human flesh. Now, before we go to Genesis, the sixth chapter, I want to ask you a question. Since they can do almost anything, what's going to stop rich parents from coming in and saying to the doctor, now, doctor, you know, we've got this son, and we know, we can tell just by the way that he is built, that he is going to be a mammoth and fantastic football player. Now, if you can insert into his system to make him bigger and stronger and tougher and meaner than anyone else. You know, he can earn 50 to 100 million in his lifetime. Now, we want our son to be that. Now, I want us to think in terms that it's very difficult for Christians to think in. But I want us to understand that maybe before the flood, they were doing such things. Maybe some of the old drawings we saw of a half-human body and an animal body were actually a carryover from what may have been done before the flood. So let's go to Genesis, the 6th chapter, and let's read this. And let's see if we can have a little bit more understanding concerning this than we've had in the past. And maybe this is one of the clues that Jesus wanted us to know and understand that's taking place. Because after all, he told us to watch. And if we're watching, what's going to happen? We're going to learn things. Does Jesus want us to learn things? Yes, he does. Let's read Genesis 6, beginning in verse 1. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Now, some people have said sons of God means the angels. I don't find anywhere that angels can cohabit with human beings. But the word Elohim, which this is the sons of Elohim, and Elohim is the same word where God told the children of Israel, you shall have no other gods before me, Elohim. Elohim also means mighty ones, and is translated in other places, mighty ones or mighty judges. So maybe these were not the combination of angels and mankind, but maybe it was something that was engineered. Maybe these were the sons of the mighty one, saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took to them wives, all which they chose. Selective breeding. Why were they doing that? Could it be that something was done to the human genetic system? Could it be that they were crossbreeding and trying to make gigantic, tremendous, fantastic super race? I believe so. Because what has always been the goal of Satan the devil? To make a super race. Was he on the verge of doing that? Let's read on, because there are a couple clues here that tell us something very important. So God the Lord said, verse 3, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he is also flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. That's all the longer they had from that time of that pronouncement, was 120 years until the flood came. Now notice verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days. Why were there giants? What were they doing? Was this selective breeding? Could they also be accomplishing adding genes, taking away genes? What did it produce? Had giants. What also did it produce? And also after that, when the sons of God, or the sons of the mighty ones, came in unto the daughters of men, that they bear them children, to them the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. And I guess they would be renowned. You know, some of the athletes that we have today, or we can see on television at any one time, oh, they're great stars. They're great heroes. Well, just think if they had abilities that were even greater than what we're able to see that they have in performing the athletic feats that they do now. What if, for example, that they were able to cross certain animal characteristics into human flesh through the genetic thing? There would be no rejection of that, because you're putting in a genetic characteristic. Just think, what could they do? What were they doing to the human race? We have a clue. Here, we'll read it. Verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. Is not what is going on now? Is this not wickedness? Is this not absolute wickedness? Tapping into the creative powers that God put within the body and the cell and the properties of all living things? Is that not wickedness to do? I say that it is. Could it be that that's what they were doing there? Very possible. Was very great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Hebrew gives the also the meaning from his youth up. Are we dealing with more than just problems of sexual nature? Are we dealing here with more than problems of just violence and killing? Well, we're having that at the end time too, aren't we? But you know, when Jesus returns, he's not going to destroy all human life. Perhaps maybe as much as from 1/5 to 1/4 of all human beings that are living at that time will be alive after Christ is on the earth. And they will be the first ones to submit to the government of God, submit to the rule of Christ, and maybe have a chance for salvation. But what was so horrendous that they were doing here, that God had to destroy all human and animal life except that he had in the ark? What were they doing? If Jesus says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Could it be that they were doing some of these very things? You know, there are some indications to suggest that they were getting into space travel, that they were flying, that they had technologies that were so advanced that we don't even understand all the things that they tapped into. And remember, they were all of one language and they all lived many, many hundreds and hundreds of years. Verse 6, and it repented the Lord that he made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. What was so evil and awful and wretched that God was grieved in his heart? And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping things and the fowls of the air, for it repented me that I've made them. But, verse 8, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generation, or perfect in his pedigree. And Noah walked with God. Could this be telling us that Noah's genetic inheritance was untampered with? He was perfect in his pedigree? Could this be telling us that the problem before the flood was greater than intermarriage? Could this tell us that they were doing such profound things with the human race that God had to destroy all the genetic resource of all of those human beings and animals because of their sin? Now, we can't say dogmatically that that is true. But on the other hand, can we deny that that may have not really been what was happening? I mean, you think about it. God, whose greatest characteristic is a God of mercy and a God of grace and a God of understanding, why would it have to be so rotten and evil and wretched that God would have to destroy all human life? Now let's go back to chapter 11. Let's go back to chapter 11. Finish one verse here. The earth was also corrupted before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, and all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. Now back to chapter 11. So right after the flood, everything becomes instantly organized again, and they go right back to what they were doing. They go right back, although they did not have all the equipment and things they needed to do what they were probably doing before the flood. But they start again. So that's why God had to confound the languages. Verse 1, and the whole earth was of one language and one speech. And it came to pass that as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And They had brick for stone, and they had slime for mortar, and they said, go to, let us build a city, and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and a tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. I again bring up the scripture. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Let's go to Joel, the second chapter, and I want to read about some incredible type human beings that maybe we could take another view and look at to see what may be happening. Joel, the second chapter, I won't go through the whole thing for the sake of time, but he's talking about in the day of the Lord. Now let's read about this army that we know is a type of, it is the army that's coming from the Far East, and it's coming over to the area to fight the battle of Armageddon. And this is a tremendous army. We find from Revelation, the 9th chapter, that it is an army of 200 million. So I ask the question, would it be possible to genetically engineer human beings so that they perhaps would not be vulnerable to woundings? Could it be possible that you could genetically engineer someone to take a hit from a bullet that it wouldn't even phase the flesh or they wouldn't bleed? Could it be possible that you could genetically engineer human beings to be fierce, absolutely incredible warriors in violence beyond our understanding? It's possible. Let's read it here. Let's read. It says in verse 4, speaking of this army, says the appearance of them is the appearance of horses, and as horsemen shall they run. Is it possible to genetically engineer such stamina and such incredible abilities that they could be just like horses? I don't know. But let's say maybe the Bible is telling us exactly what it's going to be like, more than just symbolism. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of mountains, shall they leap? Like the noise of the flame of fire, shall they devour the stubble? And as a strong people set in battle array, before their face the people shall be much pained, and all faces shall gather blackness. They shall run like mighty men. They shall climb upon the wall like men of war. They shall march every one on his own way, and they shall not break ranks. Neither shall one thrust another. They shall walk every one in his path, and when they shall fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. Maybe, with understanding what human beings are capable of doing, we're beginning to understand that perhaps the scripture is telling us a little more, or maybe a whole lot more, than we have given credit for understanding in the past. You see, we only understand what we know in the way of knowledge. We only understand as we are watching and looking and viewing and seeing. So we need to view more things than just events that are taking place in the way of politics, in the way of religion. We also need to view what mankind is doing technologically, because we're seeing a tremendous advance in that. So one of the things we need to look for and watch for, and remember this verse, as Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Are we seeing this? Are we seeing the genetic alteration of humankind? Is it going to happen again? And is that one of the major reasons why God had to destroy all flesh in the flood? Well, these are the things that we need to look at so we can know where we are in prophecy.